Hello and welcome to edition 418 of the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, and Matt Alagaya.
On this week's show, Shakespeare, but not as you've seen his work before. We'll be discussing why film director Phyllida Lloyd has just shot a new version of Julius Caesar with an all-female cast.
We'll also be hearing from musician Daniel O'Sullivan. He'll be talking about his new album, Veld, and why he's in demand from bands ranging from Sun to This Heat.
And we'll also be putting the world to rights, their human rights, that is, with barrister and founder of rightsinfo.org, Adam Wagner. He'll be telling us why our everyday freedoms are something never to be taken for granted.
All that, plus Monocle's Bill Luty will be denying every listener the basic right to a logical or cohesive start to the programme in his news look ahead. And we'll play some great music for you too right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, and Matt Alagaya. So, Matt, what a pleasure. I think this might be certainly the debut of you and I together on the Monocle Weekly. And can I start by saying it's a pleasure to spend my Sunday lunchtime with you, Matt?
It has been absolutely fantastic. And yes, my first time on this show. I mean, obviously, people will know me from The Briefing and other serious shows like that.
Popular demand? No. He's here in spite of clear public requests. In fact, directly to the contrary.
Absolutely. I mean, we've had emails virtually since I started the company saying that I shouldn't be on shows.
There's a big folder on the server.
Yeah, exactly.
Matt Alagaya complaints.
And yet,
there
I
aren't,
am.
Of course. Here you are. And I'm very much looking forward to the programme. We've got lots of intriguing things. We'll be treading the boards. We'll be talking great music. And we got some heft in there as well.
Absolutely, yeah.
Talking human rights. Doesn't get more important than that, you could argue.
No, exactly. It was really interesting actually talking to Adam Wagner. We'll be talking to him a bit later on about human rights and his organisation, rightsinfo.org. And then, obviously, Phyllida Lloyd. We'll be talking to the director of a new Julius Caesar then.
We should warn our listeners, wherever they are in the world, about what's going to happen next. Because the time is right for the news look ahead. Who's in the big chair this week, Matt?
Sitting next to me on my left, it is Bill Luty. Everyone will know his voice and his lovely face. and he is going to be doing our news look ahead.
Let's jump into the news look ahead right now.
Which way are you going, Billy? Can I go too?
Where are you going, Billy?
Well,
in the news look ahead this week?
A number of places. It's quite like, it's silly season, I think. It's the summer. There's all this stuff going on. Loads of events of hilarity. We've had ugly dog competitions, spacemen conventions. We're going to get serious for a second and head to France. July the 14th, that's Friday, is Bastille Day.
Big old Bastille Day.
How much do you know about French history, fellas?
How long have we got? Anything particular this year? New broom, of course, in the Élysée Palace. I don't know. Does that change the nature of the celebration?
Well, he hasn't done it. He's been trying to do things not by the book, so we could expect to see something not by the book. I don't know if we should mention the fact that the French police thwarted an assassination plot of Emmanuel Macron, so hopefully that doesn't happen.
That was going to happen on Bastille Day, they said.
Yeah but not anymore. Should we stay in France?
Let's do it.
In Paris. It's the European Rubik's Cube Championship.
Oh, I've seen these before.
Fantastic.
This is pretty extraordinary.
Have you seen them? Yeah.
Is it a race? Is that how it
they
works?
They are
is it...
fast as you like. It's not just one race. They do it loads of times. Sometimes pitching to try and get a world record, which is something like 1 second or something insane like that.
The world record is 4.73
seconds.
4 seconds?
That's unbelievable.
Right, to do that...
Who's been mixing that up before, though? I wonder if they've got, they've paid someone off to just mix it in a certain way so they can do it really
No, easy. It's very, very strictly regulated.
The winner, I was watching lots of YouTube videos.
At work.
At work during my time in the office. And to do it that quickly, he needed to do 9 movements per second. So he did 40. It's just like, no.
Generally speaking, I don't encourage our listeners to abandon ship and go and watch YouTube videos because, frankly, there are better ways to spend your time. However... Bill's not wrong. It actually is worth looking at because it's quite extraordinary.
I
imagine you were a bit. Were you not a bit of a
all right,
Rubik's
what are you about
Cube
to say?
Twiddler in your younger days? No.
No, I was sort of more of a chess player, to be honest. I was in the chess team, but
speed chess,
Cube.
And he never stops going on about it.
If you want to look that up, it's Felix Zemdegs. He's the world record holder. He's a professional, so you'd expect him.
Quite a good name
for
it, actually, as well.
He's a professional Rubik's Cube solver.
Yeah, that's his job. Well, you can do it in 4.73 seconds, so he may as well. Else
someone surely
do?
Has to but be paying
it
him.
It implies
to do
that he can make a living.
Yeah, well, in the European Championships, there are prizes of up to €1,000. So, I mean,
that'll last him the year.
I suppose so. He's probably on the nightclub tour as well, to be fair.
Yeah, exactly. Just making appearances. I want to talk to you about the Mega Minx.
Come again, Bill.
The Mega Minx is a type of Rubik's Cube. I'd never heard of it before.
Is it a really big Rubik's Cube?
It's a dodecahedron. A prize to whoever can tell me how many sides a dodecahedron has.
12.
12.
Good. Well done.
Yeah.
You can't talk to a man like Matt Allagaia with his classical education.
Yeah, true.
And ask him Latin-rooted word questions. He'll be seeing you off all day.
That's true.
One more?
In a way.
And you might like this one. Well, Matt, you might like this as well. You're sporting chaps, aren't you? Well, why not head to Finland? To Hirvensalmi. It's the Swamp Soccer World Championships.
Swamp soccer, you say, Bill? Is it, as the name suggests, a game of football played in a swamp?
In a massive muddy puddle. People literally up to their waists. Like,
surely,
wading.
If you're waist deep in mud,
how do you get your foot?
A foot-based game is the last thing you want to be
They're
trying.
They're just covered in it. Everyone's rolling around and slipping. I watched a video of a man fell down, and as he stood up, his pants fell down, and you could see his bum. That's on YouTube, too. This is basically an advert for YouTube.
It really is, yeah.
And also I must say, frankly, for me, useful summary of your working week, Bill. See me after the programme about how you're spending your time. Are there prizes on offer, or is it played purely for,
it's
know,
for pride.
The blood and glory?
Yeah, and bragging rights.
It sounds quite unhygienic. I worry about this.
Yeah, well, mud, especially, it's quite hot at the minute. And I know it's not, you know, it's quite north in up north in Finland, but it's really sunny up there.
Yes, but think, mud baths. You're cooling off, aren't you? Think of a hippopotamus, for example.
Oh, protecting yourself.
Natural sun protection.
Natural
for the skin
UV
as well.
Protection.
So actually, it's very much the perfect time to do this.
And then hop off into the sauna afterwards.
Thank you very much, Bill Luthi. That's next week's news today.
Thanks very much, Bill. We'll be speaking to film director Phyllida Lloyd in just a moment.
Now, you might think the works of William Shakespeare have been performed so many times that there's no new spin to place on the most significant playwright in the history of the written word.
But, Tom, you would be wrong.
Not for the first time, Matt.
Why not recast every character, including the leading man, as women? That was the aim of the Donmar Warehouse's adaptation of Julius Caesar, which was first produced in 2012, setting the tragedy within the confines of a women's prison.
The production certainly received rave reviews. The play has now been captured as a film. Calling the shots is director Phyllida Lloyd, whose past screen successes include Maggie Thatcher biopic The Iron Lady, featuring Meryl Streep, and ABBA musical Mamma Mia, also starring Streep, Pierce Brosnan, and many more besides. A little earlier, she sat down with you, Matt, to tell you more about it. First, though, let's hear a clip from the new piece.
Beware the Ides of March.
Ooh, bit of Shakespeare.
As Caesar loved me, I weep for him. As he was fortunate, I rejoice at it. As he was valiant, I honour him. But as he was ambitious, I slew him.
So, Tom, I started by asking Phyllida Lloyd about how it's different returning to a play like that when you know you're going to be making a film out of it.
I've always been a bit sceptical about theatre on film. I think it's a really hard thing to take something from a live performance and give an audience something more than they could have enjoyed in the theatre. But that really was our mission with this, to go, OK, you might have seen this in the theatre or you might not, but I can promise you that I'm taking you where you could never have been had you been sitting there watching it. Because traditionally, theatre on film's they tend to stay back quite wide for fear that they're going to miss something. But because I knew what I was going for, we've taken the cameras right in, and Harriet Walter, who plays Brutus particularly, is one of those, is very electric on screen, and you can really go in really tight and sort of feel, you know, you're getting really something quite extraordinary.
It's been described as a kind of guerrilla style of filming. I mean, you've got GoPros, iPhones are used at points, the cameras are on stage as well. Tell me a little bit about why you decided to use that kind of style.
I think, again, it's partly to do with the fact that the tradition of capturing theatre from a live performance is quite a static thing, and because the audience are generally sitting where you want the cameras to be. But the advantage of this staging, which was in the round, was that I could get the cameras really where you would put them where you were making a movie. So you can get right onto the actors' eye lines and shoot reverses as you would. And I brought in feature film editors to work on this. And somehow the combination of being able to get the camera where you want it to be and also shooting extra handheld footage and GoPro stuff to create the something of the chaos and violence of the prison world, which is, you know, this is all being performed by women in prison. And without that camera movement, I think it would have just felt a little bit sort of staid.
And did this come together really in the editing at the end of it? I mean, you obviously filmed it simultaneously on various different cameras. Did you know exactly beforehand which camera you were going to go to for which lines, or did it all really come together in the editing?
A combination of things. I was always trying to hope that we'd got for the sort of key to a lot of it, sort of key two-hander scenes, that I'd got the coverage, you know, as I say, right on the actor's eye line. But then a lot of stuff we were grabbing, I was myself shooting one of the GoPros dressed as a prisoner hidden under one of the seats, and we did grab as much as we possibly could, and then the edit was a really very creative phase.
How much was this simply about kind of recording and capturing what was, I mean, everyone said, you know, a groundbreaking production of Julius Caesar? Because obviously, you know, normally once a run is done, you're left with the reviews, but you're not, you know, and the memories, but not any sort of record of it.
I mean, I hate the word capture because I think it suggests, you know, going in and raiding what the actors have done. And I really didn't want it to be that. It was much more of a collaborative. They were very complicit in what I was trying to do with the cameras. I see it as not just a record, a legacy, but something that sort of stands on its own, that you don't need to have seen it, you don't need to know Julius Caesar. It's very accessible. And what's key to the whole thing, aside from it being a project about women's voices, unheard voices, about diversity, about the fact that this stuff, this the so-called crown jewels of our dramatic literature, often in the hands of posh white men. And this is a very not that. It's a very diverse group. Only seven of them, oh no, rather five of the 12 have ever done Shakespeare professionally before. And they're all speaking in their own regional accents. They're in some way they're representative of perhaps people who might feel excluded from our culture.
And let's talk about the production now. As you've mentioned, it's an all-female cast and a large number of the parts are played by women who are in prison. You've spoken a bit there about the kind of the social message you wanted behind that. What do you think that adds for the audience watching the play?
Well, I think it's a strange conjuring trick we hope we're doing, where you look at these people at first and you think, how the hell are these people going to play Julius Caesar, Brutus, Cassius, these great sort of iconic figures? They come on and they do look a bit like refugees from our culture. They're all in prison uniform, they're all female, they're all shapes and sizes. And then suddenly they start to talk. And I think the miracle is how they manage to close the gap between themselves and Shakespeare's language to the point where you really think, are they making this up as they go along? And that's to do with, you know, we've been working on this for a very long time. We consider ourselves sort of world-class specialists in sort of communicating this. And oddly, even though they appear to be very unsuitable for their roles, they somehow manage to totally make you believe they are these people.
And you mentioned there, I mean, it's set in a prison, and actually it almost becomes a play within a play because you have the prisoners, they're also characters who are then putting on the play.
Yes, and one of the things we discovered in prison is that you can never ever depend on anything, any ground you're standing on, any time you're allotted. At any moment, the authority is going to come in and go, we need this space, we need this person, they're going to court, they're going off to see their probation officer. So everything has the instability and fragility that we know Caesar's Rome, you know, was a prison to the conspirators because they were so kind of constricted and nervous and their freedom of speech and movement was very confined. And so you see in the film these moments where the authorities just simply stop the show to drag someone out for their medication. At the end, they stop the show before it finishes. And so there's a tension all the time about, are we going to get through this? What's going to happen? Who's watching us? Who's in charge?
And you mentioned there that the play gets cut short at the end. And in fact, it's Harriet Walter's character, so not Brutus, but that character that plays Brutus, shouts out, "It isn't finished. You have to do something now." I'm sort of paraphrasing there.
Yeah.
It sounds like a bit of an exhortation to the audience, that. Was that what you wanted it to be? And what does it mean?
Well, so I'm going to talk about one particular night, the night Donald Trump was elected. We happened to be performing this at King's Cross to an audience of 400 16 to 18-year-old young people, most of whom had never seen Julius Caesar, some of whom had never seen Shakespeare before. And at the end, when the play was cut short, Harriet spontaneously shouted out to the audience, you know, the world's going to hell. It's being run by tyrants. We can't do anything in here. You've got to get out there and do something. And literally 400 people, kids, young people, stood up and started cheering. And you just felt this sensational electricity in the room. And it was the same sense of, no, you know, it's like the old people have failed us. We're going to get out there. And, you know, it was what we saw in the election somehow, that young people were now ready, and that this play has the power to trigger that sense of communal action.
You mentioned there that the conspirators in this play, sort of led by Brutus, feel like they're in a prison. What other things about the text made you think that actually the prison setting would be very suitable?
Yes, I mean, it's a play about freedom and justice, and we took it into Holloway Prison. I had this idea that by setting the play in a prison, it would help the audience believe the action of the play, but I wondered whether this was just an intellectual notion. So I took it into Holloway, worked with a group of women, and found that their obsessions with freedom and justice, their sense of superstition, which the play is absolutely shot through with, and their apprehension of danger, their knowledge of violence, all of these things, they declared the play at the end of the time we spent there as highly suitable to their world. That was really what gave us the confidence to put it here.
I mean, obviously, this is an all-female cast. This is probably one of Shakespeare's most male plays. And there aren't many female characters here, definitely not a main female character. How do you think it changes the play when all the male parts are played by women, particularly when you think that in the original performances in Jacobean theatre, even the few women would have been played by men?
I think it reveals that Shakespeare was supremely aware of not the difference between men and women, but how society corrals men and women into certain patterns of behaviour and, in a way, imprisons them. The play, you keep hearing the men's fear of appearing womanish. The worst thing they can think of is, they say, our yoke and sufferance have made us womanish. And that somehow their fear of being feminine, of appearing to be feminine, there's a scene in which Mark Antony is very embarrassed because he cries. A servant comes on, sees Caesar's body and is weeping, and Mark Antony's like, oh gosh, you know, you've started something here, mate. And you realise that men are struggling not to cry. They're struggling not to feel, not to express anything. Just as Portia, the female character, is clearly a very powerful, she talks about she is the daughter of Cato, Caesar's greatest enemy. So you know she's a ferocious force, and yet she's completely constricted, stuck in the house. Her husband won't talk to her or tell her the important things that are going on. So I think somehow by seeing it being performed by women, you suddenly think, gosh, this is actually a play about love and friendship and people with desperate, what we would think of as feminine emotions, stuck in this pattern of warmongering and power, and how on earth to break this cycle of violence. You know, it's a play about regime change. What happens if you make a violent, you know, uprising? When we opened the play, Gaddafi had just been overthrown, and it shows how after these uprisings, there's a descent into factions and civil war. And we've watched this again and again and again in the last 5 years we've been doing it. The Arab Spring, you know, the aftermath in Iraq, the chaos that comes after an act of violence.
And part of the reason why you did this as an all-female cast was the clear imbalance in theatre between parts for men and parts for women. I guess leaving aside new writing for a moment, which is obviously different, do you think all-female casts or this kind of fluidity when it comes to the gender of the actors is a way that you can do Shakespeare and the rest of the kind of the canon and write that somehow, imbalance?
Well, I think that the joy of Shakespeare is that somehow when you perform it with one gender or another, all one, somehow the patterns of the plays become really clear. You stop getting bogged down in the individual boys and girls and suddenly think, oh my God, I see that's what he was trying to say, because the plays were never written to be performed realistically. It's a new thing, really turn of the 19th century, when people started trying to do these plays, you know, put them in certain periods and social, literally realistic social situations. They'd always been done in modern costume up until that time. By having these experiments, breaking up the traditional entitlements, really, is what we're trying to say, you can suddenly, you can offer up new patterns of what is a leader, you know, what's a wife, what's a friend, and just start to question how we do fall into tyrannizing stereotypes.
I'd like to sort of talk more generally about your career. You've obviously directed Mamma Mia. You've done lots of screen and stage as well. What's next for you? What are you working on at the moment that we can look forward to?
I'm first of all going to go on and do more of this work because I feel it's really important for... I want to, you know, do work that really speaks to the next generation and creates sort of, I hope and inspiration for people who feel maybe... not part of it and think it's not for them. I'm also happen to be working at the moment on a musical about Tina Turner, and that's going to be in the theatre next year. That's another incredible story of female empowerment, somebody who really was, you know, a sort of incredible heroic life, someone who was brought to ground zero and then rose back up to become a sort of mighty force and role model in the music industry. That's very exciting, and I'm hoping to do another movie next year.
Phila Deloyd in conversation with Matt. You can see the filmed production of Julius Caesar in UK cinemas from the 12th of July. This is the Monocle Weekly. We'll be heading from literature to the world of music. Daniel O'Sullivan is up next. Matt, how's the Monocle Weekly going for you? I'm loving it.
I'm really enjoying it, yeah. I think Bill talking about mud baths in Finland was certainly a highlight of my week, really.
We set the bar low. Exactly. That way we can only get better from there. Let's hear something new right now. This is British musician Daniel O'Sullivan. Stick around, because we're going to be hearing from himself after the song. This is from his new record, Veld. This is Hic Sunt Dracones.
Daniel O'Sullivan there with Hic Sunt Dracones from his new album, Veld. O'Sullivan is a musician who is just as at home, sitting in with the avant-garde noise rock of recently reformed experimentalists, This Heat, now known as This Is Not This Heat, to extreme experimental metalers Sun O. And his albums as part of the duo Grumbling Fur have been acclaimed for their melodic touch and off-kilter sensibility.
For his latest album, Veld, Daniel explores some of those experimental sounds and some more familiar pop stylings. A little earlier, our producer, Monocle's Tom Hall, sat down with him to learn more.
It's kind of a document of recordings that I made in this house that I lived in Tottenham, Tower Gardens Road, which belonged to a friend of mine, a great artist, Ian Johnston, who was involved with Coil and produced a lot of artworks for Coil and costumes and things over the years. I basically set my studio up there for a few years, and it was a very sort of remote parallel suburb. Even though it was in the city, it felt kind of somehow detached.
Right.
So it was quite easy to access strange sidereal worlds in sound because it was already such a sort of temple.
Yeah. I mean, I did a little research prior to this interview. You'll be glad to know. I read your description of at least one of the tracks on the album, The Swimmer, where you were talking about this sense of sort of solitude in this suburban sort of surroundings you are finding yourself in. I think the suburbs are quite an interesting mindset. I am from a suburb, you know.
So many of us are.
Exactly. Yeah. And I've spoken to, you know, I've spoken to everyone from just everyday folk to celebrated artists about this. And there is a sort of in-betweenness that rises from that, isn't there? This, I think there's a strange kind of acceptance of being in the middle of something and not quite knowing whether you should be pulled to the city or sort of chilling out closer to the country. It's just this strange in-between. Does that feed into the record?
Yeah, I mean, the in-between spaces are kind of what I'm interested in, generally speaking, in music, you know, sort of evading easy categorization, you know, just because I find that sort of the most fascinating thing when you sort of, when you look at the sort of polarities in music, you kind of phase them and therefore you sort of get, you know, other sort of insight into sound and music. Yeah, I mean, growing up in the suburbs, I always felt I was kind of swimming upstream to some extent, you know. I always felt sort of somehow kind of outside, even though I was very much inside.
Mm.
I suppose it's that sort of duality of wanting to communicate and wanting to sort of create a language that's somehow universal, you know, like pop or whatever,
yeah,
you know, but sort of infusing the atoms with everything that you've gone through, you know, and everything that your life is about, you know, which is very not, very unpopular, rather, you know. So it's infusing pop music with unpopular influences, you know, using it as a vessel.
Do you think there's something inherent about the character of the suburbs, which is, it's sort of characterised by everyone else's view? You're not really ever allowed to say, like, I'm from the suburbs and I quite like it. That's never going to be a cool view, is it? It's like the people in the city, they're the sort of arty, cultured types, and the people beyond the suburbs, they're not supposed to care because they're in the land and in nature, and then you're somewhere in between. I mean,
yeah.
Is this record some kind of maybe like a light statement about just being where you are is okay?
Being where you are is okay is a good way of putting it, yeah. Although I suppose that there was no sort of conscious, you know, raison d'etre with it. It was just...
No hardline agenda.
No. No, I don't believe in those.
Yeah. Of course. And tell us about some of the other work you've been doing. I mean, we were just talking before the mics came on. You've been in Wales just in the last week working on a new record. It seems like you're forever popping up in interesting new bands. What's the latest stuff that you've been working on?
Well, I was just working with Thaipul Sandra, also from Coil, and Jessica, who I do Lani Akea with, Jessica Moss and Massimo Pupolo. And yeah, we spent 4 days in his incredible studio right in the wilderness, in the Breckens, with dogs and cats and nice rugs and a vast array of vintage synthesizers and anything you could possibly want. Steinway piano, Fender Rhodes, Mellotrons, blah, blah, blah. It just goes on. It's an insane, veritable display of possibilities. So we didn't sort of plan anything, just sort of recording songs from the ether. And they came thick and fast, actually. There was no messing around. I just sat at the piano and started downloading, you know.
Specifically this record, I mean, it's a really rich, multi-layered thing. I mean, you were talking just then about, I mean, that's a different project, but you were talking about the wealth of instruments you had at your disposal. When you work, are you kind of a more is more person? Do you like to throw the kitchen sink in and then think about how you're going to try and manifest this maybe live later? Or do you try and connect the two? Do you try and think this is not practical or anything like that?
I don't really have any expectations of the song. The song sort of just comes, and then, you know, whatever you have at your disposal, you know, you can use. And it can be super minimal. You know, I've made songs out of a whistling kettle, you know.
Yeah.
Pretty much that exclusively, you know. And then I've made music, orchestral music, and, you know, things with a much broader palette. The thing is, it's that it doesn't really make a difference to me. You know, they're actually one and the same, really, you know, because if you go in close enough, if you put a sound under the microscope, so much detail in it. You know, I was having this conversation with a friend of mine the other day, and he was saying how he likes music to have perpetual changes in it. It has to be constantly moving, and if it reaches some kind of stasis, it's sort of dead for him, you
right.
know, or inert in some way. I was like, yeah, but even something that appears to be static, if you go in close enough, it's just moving really, really fast,
yeah.
you know, like drone music, for example,
okay.
you know, good drone music. You know, if you go in deep enough, there are all of these fibers swimming around and all of these textures. And,
yeah.
And it's constantly changing. It's never the same. And also, change is also equal to the radius of your awareness,
yeah,
and your perspective. If something appears not to be moving, you move your body, you move your head, you move how you speak, how you listen, you
yeah, know?
And then change occurs. Well,
it is the theory of relativity, isn't it?
Exactly.
About how things move together. I don't want to get sort of caught in a cul-de-sac of slightly drudgery-filled technicalities, but it's interesting hearing you talk about music in an almost sort of quite analytical, almost, I wouldn't say scientific way, but you've thought up there about some of the complexities going on. Do you ever try and intentionally create these kind of micro textures, or do you just sort of feel them once it's done and you're like, oh, that's there, and I didn't even quite realize it was happening while I made it?
Me personally, I sort of, everything that really resonates with me is something that I wasn't even aware of while I was making it. Usually that's the best sort of work for me. If I go in with an idea and it's very sort of structured and I'm very, you know, acutely aware of, has to be this sort of construct, you know, it normally doesn't work out. Whereas if I just go in free of expectation, free of doubt, I'll usually come up with something that's completely resonant with what's going on in my life and, you know, a reflection of the time and space that I'm in. But I think you have to sort of intuit those things. Well, me personally, I do anyway. Even with composition, you have to be there in the moment. You know, you have to be there doing it in the moment, I think. You know, that's why I'm really interested in the confluence of improvisation and composition.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
That's really important to me.
Kind of like slightly structured things where you have the space to go into really interesting situations.
Yeah, because I think the most sort of complex phrasing that I've heard comes from jazz and improvisation,
right,
you know, and sort of contemporary music as well, you know. And it's because the mind is free to sort of go on those journeys. As soon as you sort of limit yourself and decide, you know, it's got to be like this, it's got to be like this, you know, it's over, you know, game over.
Right, well, speaking of journeys, perfect segue. Let's listen to a bit of The Swimmer and we'll see where that goes. That was The Swimmer there. I mean, apparently on there we're hearing an open-tuned auto harp. Also seen mention of Orphic hymns. Tell me about what they might be.
An Orphic hymn. Well, that's just some BS, really.
Okay. I love BS. Go on, lay it on me. It's fine.
Well, I don't know. Where did that song come from? I mean, really, it just came from having this auto harp, taking all the drawbars off, putting it in an open tuning, and then having these lyrics that were somehow about, you know, I've always been interested in the idea of the sort of odum soto, which is a sort of this concept that comes up in Rumi,
okay,
of like something that sort of leaves, or sort of like the swimmer, swims against the current,
right,
you know, swims
yep,
against the current. And then by doing that, you're able to sort of cultivate a witness because you can see the speed of everything going past you, you know, and you're working harder, but you get to observe not only yourself, but everything else, you know. It's kind of about sort of, you know, in that sense, sort of the Orphic idea of sort of coming out of the underworld into some sort of freedom or light, you know. And that's just mirrored in the process of just being creative and just sort of making work and, you know, being dedicated, you know.
Yeah. And when you play with other bands, I mean, it's quite interesting because you've joined other acts maybe when they've reformed or maybe later in their careers as well. And I find that quite interesting about how you complement that sound, because you yourself, you seem like a very driven and focused artist who knows exactly what you want. And certainly in any sort of creative endeavor, whether it be music or art or anything, I mean, we've all dabbled, you know. And it's like, I've personally found that if I have a strong opinion about something, it's quite difficult to just go and fit into like another person's band or another person's outfit. Do you manage those two roles just quite affably? Are you just quite happy to sit in with other musicians, or do you want to be kind of try and pushing the agenda a bit as well?
Initially, I only sort of really get involved with bands that I'm interested in and want to learn from.
Yeah.
You know, there's something about their method that sort of I find mysterious, you know, and want to, you know, like with this Heat, for example,
yeah.
You know, there's so much going on in those records, you know, so much, so many details that are sort of submerged, and I've always wondered, you know, what the process of making them, what, so, you know, from that sort of more geeky
yeah.
perspective, but also just emotionally, and how they became sort of politicized, you know, as a group, and how they addressed that in a sort of really amazing, archaic, sort of allegorical way.
Yeah.
And at the same time, it had this kind of almost sci-fi sort of post-nuclear landscape. Again, for me, that's like polarities sort of being squashed somehow by addressing both at the same time, by being, you know, in that sort of, having that sort of multiverse mindset, taking sort of manifold ideas from the past, from the future, and presenting them as one thing.
I mean, we should sort of tell listeners the band you're talking about, This Is Not This Heat, who originally kind of known as This Heat. I understand, were they in the, was that the 70s that they were sort
yeah.
of first around? Sort of really, yeah, really kind of expansive, forward-thinking, noisy outfit, but with some really beautiful melody and stuff intertwined with that. I'm just interested, I mean, how does that come about where you end up in that band? Is that something that you were actually interested in before and you had to apply for the job, or do you have to stick your hand up? What happens? Do they just say, oh no, there's Daniel O'Sullivan, he does cool stuff, he can come in and play? I mean, how does that work?
Well, I knew both of them.
Yeah.
I knew Charles, because Charles gets around, you know, Charles Hayward's never really stopped improvising, making records, writing songs. And Charles Bullen was a bit sort of off radar, and I was always really intrigued about his trajectory after This Heat. He made one record with Lifetones.
Right.
I met him. He asked me randomly to write the liner notes for the reissue of the Lifetones record on Light in the Attic, which I was, you know, I was really buzzing about that, although I'm not really a writer, but, you know, I just gave my perspective on it, I suppose. And then, you know, conversation came up about, you know, to celebrate 40 years of This Heat, Light in the Attic again reissued those two albums and the EP. Yeah, and they asked me to do it, and I was blown away.
I saw the band earlier this year, and this was at Primavera in Barcelona, and yeah, it was an absolute standout of the weekend. It was I was completely unfamiliar with them, and I was kind of amazed I was unfamiliar with them, because I do kind of dig that sort of, like, I like a lot of sort of proto-punk and all that stuff in the 70s, and for some reason they just totally slips under my radar. Yeah, amazing.
I think they do with a lot of people, but again, that's because they don't really fit comfortably into
yeah.
any sort of categorization.
Yeah. Just finally, I think we should give a shout out to a mutual friend of ours, Astrid Stieholder, who is the musician Paper Dollhouse. She appears on the record. How did you get involved with the collaborators on this record? Because she's not the only one. You have some other interesting people on there, right?
Yeah, just friends. I can't even remember how I met Astrid. I think it was through Grumbling Fur gigs or something, maybe playing with Paper Dollhouse at some point. Just sort of shared affinities, you know. Also, you know, it was kind of one of my sort of agendas with this record was to sort of laminate my voice with other voices.
Yeah.
Especially with certain songs where I'm addressing something that's more to do with sort of the unconscious collective, a universal voice, you know, so both genders, young, old, coming from all over the shop, you know, but just presented as one sound, one unison sound, you know. So Astrid sort of was instrumental in doing that with one song. And then, yeah, I mean, there's not that many guests on it, I guess. It's just sort of people that were around, friends. But Astrid's playing live with me as well. We're doing this sort of Veld album launch at Otto on July 13th, so she'll be joining me for that as well.
Daniel O'Sullivan there, speaking to Monocle's Tom Hall. His new record, Veld, is out now on Tim Burgess's O'Genesis label. Those in London can go and check Daniel out live this Thursday, 13th of July, at Café Otto, and Paper Dollhouse will be performing too.
You're listening to The Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, and Matt Alagaya. We'll be learning more about our human rights and yours after this.
All human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights. That's Article 1 of the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights, in case you needed a refresher. And someone committed to keeping our knowledge of human rights up to date, clear and firmly in the public eye, is barrister Adam Wagner.
He's the founder of the information site rightsinfo.org and also the UK Human Rights blog. And whether it's a crackpot dictator or Theresa May trying to take your rights away from you, and the two aren't necessarily mutually exclusive, then Adam is the man to speak to. He joins us now to tell us what nobody can tell us not to do. Welcome to the Monocle Weekly, Adam. Good to
Thanks
speak
very much
you.
For having me.
What about a starting point? Are our human rights in peril? Is this crisis mode for the protection of these supposedly universal rights and dignities?
Well, it depends which way you look at it. I think that we are lucky that we live in a democracy. We live in an established democracy that's been protecting our rights for a long time. Having said that, not everybody in society has the same protection. If you're reasonably wealthy, if you're a white male, you probably do pretty well. If you're from a poor background, or if you're a woman, or if you're black, or if you're gay, you might find you're being discriminated against. You might find that your right to housing is not being complied with. You might find that you don't have the same free speech rights as other people. And human rights laws are really meant to be a check and a balance on democracies. They're designed for all kinds of societies, but they only really work in a democracy where there's the rule of law. And our human rights laws are, to an extent, under threat. We've got a prime minister who has been very critical of our human rights laws, particularly the Human Rights Act and the European Convention on Human Rights, which are our two main laws which protect us and which give this backstop against anti-democratic or anti-free speech or anti the right to liberty government. So I think that we are in a bit of a crisis moment.
Is it? I mean, it seems like it might be one of the great delusions that we actually think of human rights abuses as only occurring in dictatorships in far-flung lands. I mean, is part of your job trying to tell people that actually our human rights here in you know, Western Europe are also under threat?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that people can be a little bit naive about how well rights are protected in our society, maybe because the people who are making decisions in government or writing articles are very comfortable. But if you look at, for example, the Grenfell fire, and we don't know what caused it yet, and we don't know exactly what happened, but we do know that those people were in social housing. They had a right to safety, a right to life, a right to decent housing. And for some reason, their home burned down and about 100 people died. Now, their rights weren't being protected by somebody, assuming this wasn't just a big, horrible accident. And it just really just what I'm trying to do and what RightsInfo is trying to do is broaden out the rights conversation to not just be about, you know, prisoners of conscience in Bahrain, but about effectively a prisoner in a care home who, I mean, we looked at the story recently. We did a documentary about Stephen Neary, who's severely autistic and who was placed in care against the wishes of his father, who looked after him for around a year. And he used the Human Rights Act to, his father used the Human Rights Act to get Stephen released. And that's just a good example of, you know, he may not be a prisoner of conscience in Bahrain, but he was nonetheless had his liberty taken away from him by the state.
Adam, I wanted to ask you a little bit then about the tools at your disposal, some of the methodologies that you deploy to inform people, to help them become better informed and maybe better custodians themselves of their own rights and those of the people around them. Is it about developing compelling media messages? Is it about, I don't know, different kinds of social outreach? What does your sort of toolkit look like?
Well, I think you've hit the nail on the head. Those are the two main tools that we use. So I started looking about 3 years ago at some of the messaging and framing evidence which is out there over human rights, which is fascinating. Especially, it's become more fascinating in a way in the context of fake news and the post-Brexit debate, because what all the evidence was showing was that their view of human rights was being framed by mostly by the right-wing tabloids. So they were thinking of human rights as for prisoners, for criminals, for pedo-rapists, as The Sun calls them in their human rights coverage. And that was really affecting and corroding people's support for human rights, but also affects people's knowledge, because they think, well, the human rights are for other people, they're not for me. And those viewpoints map on exactly to EU, to anti-immigration, to all of the sort of keystone issues. What our framing evidence also talks about is how you can flip that around and reframe the debate, which is really what we're trying to do. So one of the key messages that that evidence suggests is that you shouldn't myth bust. You shouldn't try and take on untruthful or mischievous reporting about human rights cases being all about terrorists and, you know, this kind of thing. You've got to start from the beginning and you've got to create your own frames. So we try and build perfectly true knowledge about human rights, which comes out of, you know, hospital care, people in old age homes, children in education, disabled people, the right not to be discriminated against. So really sort of fleshing out areas of the law which other people, which people just don't read about, because it's only in sort of The Guardian or The Independent, which a lot of people don't read. So that's the first bit. And then the second bit is methods. So we've always been entirely social media based. We will do anything to creatively bring people to human rights, accepting that people won't come just because they're interested. We want to engage people. We want to be creative. We want to be exciting. So when we look to the examples that we want to replicate, we're looking at BuzzFeed. We're looking at the people who use Facebook really well, people who use Snapchat, you know, those kind of modern communications methods that just aren't being thought of in terms of public education, especially at the beginning when we do lots of infographics and animations that sort of say, well, are you doing stuff for schools? But we're not doing stuff for schools, because it just happens that if you want to engage people, you use the same methods that people who are trying to speak to bored 16-year-olds for adults. And it works. And we've had millions of people through the door as a result of that.
I mean, I was wondering, you mentioned there that you're kind of having to reframe the narrative a little bit because so many people's understanding of human rights is so warped. Accessibility, as you said, is very important. The fact that you have to make it feel more accessible, because it's quite a kind of difficult thing to get your head around. So you're using these tools like social media. Just give an example of something that you've done quite recently, I guess, that was really effective, that had a great response, where you saw people understanding something in a different way because of your tools.
We wanted to get around this idea that human rights are kind of some sort of left-wing conspiracy imposed by the French on the British. I mean, the reality is, you look at the history, human rights came out of a quite strongly conservative movement in the UK, particularly led by Winston Churchill and the Tory Home Secretary, whose name was David Maxwell Fyfe. And they were really worried about communism. They were actually really worried about the new Labour government and the first post-war Labour government and about socialism. And they saw civil and political rights as a kind of guarantee in the UK and across Europe of this sort of classic British rule of law-based society, sort of implementing them in the legal systems. And that's the real story. Of course, there's nuances to that. To tell that story, created an animation. We worked with the people at the Met Film School, who did a really kind of nice cutout animation about the David Maxwell Fyfe story. And it's been viewed, I think, close to a million times. I mean, it's really, and it gets shared a lot around the times that Theresa May stands up and says things like, the European Convention on Human Rights does nothing for Europe, it does nothing for our prosperity, it does nothing for our security. Part of the answer to that is, you're undermining your own history in a way, in our own history, because this is something we should be proud of, regardless of whether you're a Labour or Conservative supporter.
Adam, you mentioned about adopting some methodologies that people use to talk to children maybe when they're at school. And on that point about education, I wonder, I get the sense that we put quite a lot of emphasis and priority and maybe funding into making kids at school aware of what their responsibilities socially are as they go through life. Do we spend enough time talking about what their rights are? I mean, I wonder, is this something like so many of these issues where you can actually make people better informed if you get them early enough? Would you like to see a shake-up of how people understand what their actual human rights are, quite fundamentally, you know, right back from when they're, I don't know, even in primary school, far less even secondary school?
Without a doubt. And I've done work with primary school kids, and they really get this stuff, because actually, you know, if you've got children, they talk a lot about what's fair and what's not fair. They've got a very strong intrinsic understanding.
They bring that up a lot.
They've got a really good instinctive understanding of fairness, of justice and fairness, actually. So they understand rights on some level. But I think that, I mean, at the moment, the citizenship education, and it used to have human rights as part of it. And I think the coalition government got a bit worried about that and made it a bit vaguer. And now they talk about the rule of law. But that's the time. In the States, you know, you've got in the public education system, you have to learn about the Constitution. That's the sort of lesson number one in civics. And British kids should be learning about that as well, because it creates this disconnect. And it's bad for people. And it's especially bad for the people who need rights the most, because they come out not knowing that they have a basic right to education, that they have a basic right to, you know, have deaths investigated. You know, it's a good example that comes up. It's coming up quite a lot at the moment because of the Grenfell Fire, because of Hillsborough. Yeah, that all that stuff comes out of human rights duties to investigate deaths. That's why we're having.
So, we get back to this thorny issue? Yeah. Sorry to jump in, but do we get back to this thorny issue about a written constitution? You know, a lot of people, it's certainly here, and we are looking at this mainly through the UK prism. But this is a, it's been vexing politicians and others and legislators for decades, really. And a lot of people say, look, Britain is good because it has flexibility, because we're not hamstrung by a constitution. Is that an unacceptably old-fashioned point of view in your opinion?
Well, I know people disagree with this, but I think flexibility is good for lawyers and people who can afford lawyers.
We don't want to help them out, do we?
Yeah, well, I think it's clarity is good for everybody else. And I would definitely support a written constitution. And in fact, we're sort of building towards one with the Human Rights Act, whatever happens post-Brexit. It's always better to have things simple and set down in one place. And it's always worse to have things in 100 different places. And I know there's this great idea of the great flexibility of the British Constitution, how wonderful it is. But it has huge disadvantages. And it really benefits the people who can pay for expensive lawyers to be able to essentially find the rights that they need and find the rules that they need. I think it is time, especially post-Brexit, when we're going to have this kind of constitutional moment.
You mentioned a couple of times, you mentioned Brexit and you mentioned Theresa May and the EU as well. Has all of this brought human rights to the front of the debate? I mean, are you seeing, is there a difference between the traffic you get when you post something that's not related to Brexit and then something that is related to Brexit? I mean, is that what people are really interested in, do you think, at the moment?
Yeah, Brexit was very, very popular in terms of our work on it around, particularly in the few months after the referendum. But we found that what's really caused a spike in our traffic was Trump. For an example, we've released a video about Holocaust Memorial Day, which was looking back at the history of human rights through the post-Holocaust history, because the human rights laws that we have now were all formed in the ashes of the Holocaust. They were all direct responses to the people who had lived through the 30s and the 40s, who looked at those societies and said, "What? How can we stop this kind of thing happening again? Well, we have to stop the small things going, you know, the small taking away of rights. Because by the time they're big, by the time you've got concentration camps, it's hopeless. Mm. You've got to bolster the rule of law." So that's where that all came from. And we posted that. And within, I think, 3 days, it had over 5 million views, because Trump, on the same day, had released his immigration ban. And people were starting to suddenly connect the dots. They're thinking, well, 1 minute, I thought I lived in a stable Western, you know, basically sort of post-history world where these weren't issues anymore. But it looks like we could be coming into a period of real turmoil. And suddenly this stuff is becoming more important and more urgent. And I think that's how, unfortunately, you know, again, talking about a time of not quite disaster, but very much
tumult, maybe.
Yeah,
upheaval.
It's unsettling. Mm. And people start thinking, well, when Jeremy Corbyn talks about taking people's flats away from them. So just as a small example, you know, taking people in Kensington, let's just appropriate people's flats. Appropriation of property is one of the most basic reasons that the human rights laws were put in place, because that's what happened to Jews and, you know, the homosexuals and whoever the fascists didn't like. The first thing they do is take all their property away from them. And I'm not comparing Jeremy Corbyn to those people, but it's in this moment where those people say, well, okay, well, why not? You know, there's this sort of populist moment where people are starting to look at ideas that they haven't looked at for quite a long time and look at actions which may not have been thought palatable even 5 years ago. So I think that's worrying.
Adam, just a very final point before we end, just to go back over what you said about not necessarily taking on the media head on, but trying to reframe your own narrative, counterpoints to Trump, counterpoints to the populist, the nationalist language that we see worryingly across, you know, even all of the Western world. Do we not need to be more confrontational about this? And do we not need to be more aggressive about restating these values? Or do you think it is enough to make a case very eloquently and cleverly as you and your colleagues do? Is that enough? Or do we need to say, look, some things are too important and people's memories are too short. We need to do more to defend these fundamental rights.
I think that that's the tension in public advocacy for these sorts of issues, because in these times, it's very easy to energise the base. Mm. The people who are the real fight, who will fight, will actually stand up and fight for human rights or the or immigration or the disadvantaged. But at the same time, we're trying to build a broader coalition. We're trying to sit more in the centre and be a comfortable place for people who are wondering, who are undecided, to say, oh, well, actually, I can be that. I don't feel, just because I'm a Tory vote, it doesn't mean I can't be in line with these values. So, or just as I'm a Jeremy Corbyn voter, it doesn't mean I can't be in line with these values. It's trying to build that consensus, but it's a lot harder.
Best of luck with it.
Thanks very much.
You've got your work cut out, Adam. But really great to speak with you. Thanks for coming to see us on the Monocle
Weekly.
Thanks
for having me.
Well, there you have it, Matt Allagaier, that's edition 418 of the Monocle Weekly. I must ask, how was it for you?
Really good. Yeah, I enjoyed that a lot. It was actually educational as well as very fun to do.
And aren't you glad that you cancelled your family Sunday lunch to come spend time with your old mate Tom?
your old buddy Tom Edwards. I really am delighted about
it's
that.
No better way to
didn't have any
Sunday.
Plans, you know. So exactly. It's actually fine. Fine to be here.
Very kind of you to say so. I don't know. It's wrong probably to choose a highlight, isn't it? And such different worlds that we walked through. Critically important. We trod the boards. Or I don't know, do you still tread the boards if it's on the silver screen? Complicated questions.
Interesting.
Musical diversions as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
It was very much the show that had everything.
It really did. Yeah, it was a cultural extravaganza.
A smorgasbord.
Really. It was, yeah.
Which is the right thing for lunchtime. Matt, I think we should thank those who put this masterpiece together, starting with our producer, Tom Hall.
Tom Hall, absolutely. And our researcher, Maya Higgard, as well. And of course, our studio manager, George McDonough, as well.
The Weekly will return next week. Who'll be in the chairs, Matt? Could be you, could be me. Might be two completely different faces, or voices, I should say.
Exactly, very exciting.
There's only one way to find out. Tune in next week. But from this week's team, that's me, Tom Edwards.
And from me, Matt Allagaier.
Goodbye, and thanks for listening.